Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Speaking of Translation. I'm Eve Baudou.
And I'm Corinne McKay. Thanks for joining us.
In this episode, we're going to cover a topic that has been a source of fascination and consternation for freelancers and pretty much everyone in the entire world, but we're going to focus on the freelance aspect, and that is the European Union's General Data Protection Regulation, or as we have come to know and love it, the GDPR. We know that there's been a lot of information about the GDPR in the news lately, and we thought it would be interesting to cover the GDPR from the angle of what we as freelancers need to do in order to comply with it. And before we begin, of course, we want to give the disclaimer that, as you know, we're not attorneys or specialists in the GDPR, and we highly recommend that you speak with someone who is a GDPR expert before making any major business decisions surrounding these issues.
So today we're going to look at the GDPR from a few angles, and we did want to stress that this is not intended to be comprehensive. It is a huge regulation and very far-reaching with a lot of different aspects. So what we're going to look at today is some aspects of the GDPR that jumped out at us as being particularly applicable to freelancers. And if there's any of this that is really mission critical to your business, or for example, if you own a large translation agency or something like that, you really do want to talk to an attorney. So I can give you an example that this has occupied a lot of time and energy at the headquarters of the American Translators Association, and ATA's law firm has an entire lawyer who just works on GDPR issues full time. So that is not what we're doing today.
No.
Today, we're going to take a quick and dirty look at things such as trying to make your website compliant with the GDPR, trying to make your email list compliant, dealing with the GDPR when it comes to things you translate, and a couple of other issues. So I think Eve's going to kick us off with, in case you have insomnia, a brief history of the GDPR.
You think I'm boring or the GDPR is boring?
No. Oh, you're the last thing from boring. I'm just saying, for anyone who has trouble sleeping, you could put on the read aloud function with the Wikipedia page on the history of the GDPR, and I think that would solve your problems.
And it would knock you out. Okay. So yeah. So I think most importantly, I know we have listeners from all over the world, but I think some of the, and especially the people in the European Union, freelancers there already know that this definitely applies to them. But we do want to point out that many people in the US are under the impression that the GDPR does not apply to them. And if you deal at all with anyone in Europe, that is probably not the case. So the GDPR applies worldwide. And if either, the GDPR applies worldwide if either the data controller, that means whoever is the entity or individual that is collecting EU resident data, so whether you live in Europe or elsewhere, and in our case, it could be something like an end client or an agency who has collected data that needs to be processed in some way, or the data collector could be a translator, him or herself, if, for example, if that translator has a large email list and that contains people's personal data. So then we have the data processor, and that's the entity who then processes that data, that personal data that's been collected. So that could be a cloud service provider that processes data that's been submitted to it, or in our case, it could be translators who process data that is given to them by an agency or an end client. So we're processing data they've given us to translate, but that data contains personal data. And then we also have the data subject, which is the person whose data is being collected or processed and who is also located in the EU. So I think depending on where you live, you could be one or more of these. You could be a data controller, you could be a data processor, or you could be a data subject. And so sum it up to say that if minimally you have access to the personal data of people who live in the EU, the GDPR does apply to you whether you live in Europe or not. So Corinne, I have much more to say on that topic, but did you want to clarify anything or talk about anything before I move on?
No, I think you hit the highlights there. I mean, I think one of the questions about the GDPR, which I've even heard lawyers muse about, is how is enforcement going to work in countries that have nothing to do with the European Union? But I think the point is, to be on the safe side, understand that if any of those three, the data collector, the data processor, or the data subject is located in the EU, then it applies.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think also, especially for a lot of translators like me, or even for enforcement purposes, I've thought about that because I thought, well, I live in the US, but I'm actually a dual national, so I don't want to get on the wrong side of the EU.
Exactly. You know,
because I am actually separately more than most people, more than regular people who, I mean, regular US citizens who don't have dual nationality, probably more subject to that than they are. So, okay. So another key factor is that the GDPR uses a pretty broad definition of what personal data actually is. So they consider it to be anything that could be used to identify an individual person. So that could be name, address, photo, email address, banking information, IP address, social media posts, and even something that you might think is more vague that could eventually be tied back to that specific person. So the core of the GDPR is that people whose data is collected or processed have 8 specific rights. So don't, so like Corinne said, you know, don't fall asleep, keep listening. This is the crux of it. So
it's actually kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think.
The 8 specific rights that it gives you.
Yeah. So one is you have the right as a data subject to be informed. You have right of access, and number 2, you have right of access to your data. You have right of rectification to have your data corrected. And number 4, you have the right to erasure, which is also called the right to be forgotten. And this is the right to have your personal data erased, which data controllers must honor under certain circumstances. And then 5th, you have the right to restrict processing of your data. How is that data processed? You have the right to affect that. 6, you have the right to data portability. And 7, you have the right to object to the use of your personal data. And 8, you have the right, you have certain rights that are related to automated decision making and profiling. I actually did a translation, as I'm sure many of us did, during the last couple months with the, you know, everything coming to a head about the GDPR. I did a translation that was, like you said, it was someone trying to figure out, you know, exactly how automated decision making would be affected, how automated processing of data would be affected. So, what else did I want to tell you guys? Let's see. So we talked about how it applies, you know, whether you live in Europe or not. And it's not restricted to entities that are in the European Union, but also outside the European Union if you interact with your European residents. So as you can tell by this list of rights, it basically gives people a lot more control about what data is collected, about them, and how it's used. And it also gives people recourse if they don't want their data to be recorded or used. So the GDPR requires the data collectors are transparent, that they be transparent about how they collect and how they use personal data. So while this is particularly concerning to larger companies, and I'm sure a lot of them, you know, some of the bigger multinationals have way more than just one person devoted to it. They have, you know, huge departments now devoted to this.
Right.
Trust me. But freelancers do have a role to play as related to the GDPR, and we cannot simply ignore it. So it does play, it does affect us, and we do need to pay attention to that regulation and comply with it. Mm-hmm. So, Corinne, I know you have many comments that you'd like to share, so over to you.
Okay. So one thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, now that we've sort of mocked the GDPR, and that overall, I feel like it is intended to give individuals a lot more power over their personal data, which in the end is undoubtedly a good thing, mm-hmm. unless you enjoy being randomly subscribed to 80 million email lists and having online advertisers know everything about you.
Yeah, no, I think me personally, and I think all of us, and looking at it from that perspective, can totally get behind it. Yeah.
Yes. That I think if you look at the spirit
right.
of the law, that I think it acknowledges that in the 21st century, that personal data is a very marketable commodity that businesses want and governments want access to, and that you should be able to, you know, understand and control how businesses and governments and individual people access and use your data. So I personally feel that overall it will probably result in some very positive changes.
Mm, me too, yeah.
So While the transition to it may be a bit of a headache, in the end, I think there are going to be a lot of benefits. So the GDPR also mandates that things like internet privacy policies must be in clear, concise language, not like 87 pages of verbose legalese. And as we've already mentioned, the GDPR for big companies is a huge, huge deal. But right now, let's look at how this affects us as freelancers. So first, and perhaps most importantly, in the spirit of not reinventing the wheel, I want to refer you to a really excellent document produced by the ITI, which is the UK Institute of Translation and Interpreting. So they produced a document called A Brief Guide to the GDPR, and I'll pause here and make fun of the GDPR a little bit again by saying jokingly that the brief guide is 11 pages. So only in the world of the GDPR does 11 pages count as a concise overview.
But it's actually not that bad, because I read through it and it didn't take that long, but yeah, it's 11 pages.
Right. So you can Google, if you Google Institute of Translation and Interpreting GDPR, you'll find it, and we'll also put a link to it in the show notes. So I would say if you have the stamina to read one thing about the GDPR, read that, because it covers a lot of issues that are specific to translators. And I think that document is also very open about the fact that some of these issues are just going to have to be worked out as the regulation is implemented. So for example, right now, it is really unclear how the GDPR regulations will affect translation memories. So many of us do work on translations that contain people's personally identifiable data. For example, I do a lot of translations for individuals, and a lot of whom live in the EU. And by definition, when you send me something to translate, like your birth, marriage, death certificates, your estate documents, your tax forms, they contain tons of personal information. So one tricky point for translators is that the one thing the GDPR discourages is storing personal data for indefinite periods of time. You're supposed to put a time limit on how long you're going to store this personal data. So the problem there is whether a translation memory counts as indefinite term storage of personal data. So whether you have to extract the personal data from your TM at some point, or the fact that the document is already broken into segments, for example, a little bit like shredding a paper document, it could be put back together, but it's not that easy. Because the data is segmented, does that mean that it can't be used in a meaningful way, and the risk of identifying someone because of the data in your TM is so low as to be acceptable? So I think we just have to see how things like that play out as the regulation is implemented. But one thing I think freelancers probably should do is choose an amount of time for which you're going to keep data on your on your computer systems. So I've seen translators, just looking anecdotally at things like people's blog posts about it, I've seen freelancers who have picked 5, 7, or 10 years. And again, we can't really advise you on those, but those are some examples. And I think some of those, some of those are based on how long you are required to keep other types of critical information. For example, in the US, the IRS recommends that you keep your tax returns for 7 years. Apparently in the UK, it's recommended to keep your tax returns for 5 years. I think that's where those come from.
Or it could also then folded into your own processes, where every year maybe you purge the things that are whatever year, 5 years or older.
So you go like, okay, I picked 7 years. Yeah. So this year I'm going to go at the end of 2018, I'm going to go through and delete all of 2011.
Exactly. You know, and I just did that for my tax stuff. So that's a good, I do that every year. I think, okay, yay, I can throw away this one because I don't need
to shred my 2011.
Not throw away. Whatever. You're right. Shred. Yeah.
Yeah.
Carefully shred. Yeah. So, okay. So I was super interested in how the GDPR would affect translation memories. And I don't have all the definitive answers, but but I did spend some time, looking into that and thinking about that. And I also reviewed a document that SDL has put out on that exact subject, and it's called get ready with your pencils. No, just kidding. We'll put it in the show notes. It's called GDPR and your use of SDL translation software. But I think that most of those ideas are applicable to any translation software, and that you could, you know, extrapolate them for whatever you use. And perhaps, I don't know, perhaps I'm sure, you know, MemoQ and other people have something out there, but I'm not particularly familiar with that because I use Studio, which is an SDL product. I do also want to say that that document seems to have been written for SDL's agency or corporate clients, but it still definitely contains information that's very interesting to independent translators and smaller businesses. So, and I wanted to talk about some of that. So, I thought it was really interesting too. They have this table where they talk about under the GDPR that translators, like, they kind of try to define in when you're thinking about translation software, who is a data processor, who is a data controller, and who is a data subject. And so they define translators as data subjects. Look at my notes here. I want to, because this gets, like Karen said, it's kind of all this legalese, so it gets confusing. So I don't want to say something that is incorrect. Yes, they consider translators as data subjects of agencies in the sense that there is identifying data for individual translators. It's often contained in translation memories too.
I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. So like what you're saying is right. We're processing data that we're getting from people, and so we're a data processor in that sense that was about someone else. But we are also a data subject because our identifying information is in translation memories, you know, in segments. And then, and they also talk about other things like different log files for project managers and things like that. But I'm not going to go there. You can read the document yourself. but I thought what was particularly interesting to me was that yes, as we are, you know, processing segments, it's always tagging, you know, usually tagging us with whatever we have set, you know, like mine, it always says go global, but that is still identifying because someone could come back and know, oh, that's the email address she uses, blah, blah, blah. It could be tied back to me. So that's one way. And then there was another thing that came to my mind that the SDL brochure didn't address, but I consider it, because it's not a function of their software, but I would personally also think that translators are also data subjects of agencies and that their information is contained in various databases, you know, that we are all contain data. And I contain data of other people too, because I have a database because I outsource, right? And so we would be considered a data subject. Because we're in agencies' databases. And so on an email list, recently I saw an inquiry from a translator who was looking for suggestions about how to cut ties with various agencies and be removed from their databases because she felt like she hadn't worked with them in a long time or she didn't like their payment plans or whatever, payment policies or whatever.
She wants to exercise her right to be forgotten.
Exactly. Right. And so, and nobody else, and maybe someone did later, but I remember I thought like, I said, I don't know that much about it, you know, but I responded and said, but I think you should think of this, especially for agencies that are in Europe, in the European Union, you're a data subject and then they would have to remove your data upon request. So anyway, so that's another way that that's related. So now I'm flipping back to thinking specifically about translation software, and SDL considers that freelance translators using, you know, the translation software are data processors or sub-data processors when they use the translation software to assist in translating data that contains personal data, which is content that contains personal data, which is what Corinne had talked about more, right, Corinne? The way you were kind of looking at it.
Like translating someone's tax returns.
Yes. And I think, so right, like we said, like it contains someone's name, a place, even a professional title, that kind of thing. So anyway, and SDL, I do want to point out though, we don't have to be freaked out about every single document that comes by our desk, right? Because SDL points out again, that GDPR only applies to personal data. And I think that's a good reminder to not go crazy, you know, that every piece of data that we touch might be, you know, might have to be dealt with this in this way. We don't, it only has to be personal data. And so I think that that can be separated from confidential data. So of course we want to respect confidential data that we get from our confidential materials that we get from our clients, but that the GDPR doesn't necessarily apply to the confidential data. So what I mean by that is, for example, if you're translating an operating manual for a new product that hasn't been released to the marketplace yet, obviously your client considers that confidential and they want you to keep that confidential. But that document probably doesn't contain any personal data. So I think that's kind of, you know, that we want to keep in mind too, the differences between confidential data and personal data. And so then also, though, I would also want to point out kind of my thought process of going through all this, that I do think things can get tricky fast, because I was going to give as an example of something that wouldn't contain personal data as a corporate internal audit report, because it's a corporate document. But then I thought, well, audit reports contain the auditor's names and contact information. So that would make them data subjects. And then that document would be subject to the GDPR. So my point is that, well, birth certificates and doctor's notes about a patient, you know, sometimes people translate that kind of thing, obviously contains personal data. You know, some other documents might too, that would less obviously be, it would be less obvious. But then again, you know, not every single document we get is going to be, is going to be containing personal data.
Right.
So, then I thought one last point I wanted to make that I kind of, the SDL brochure made me think of, was that they pointed out, or they have this idea, which I agree with actually, that GDPR compliant software is actually a myth. and the point was that any software can offer you features to help you in your quest to follow the GDPR by, for example, helping you to remove identifying information in TM segments, but that your own processes and procedures have to be in place with regard to doing this and to make it be actually successful. So they can give you the tools to do it, but they're not responsible for you doing it, because you may not actually use the tools that they gave you, right? Mm-hmm. So I thought this could also be applied to email marketing lists, for example. So as we all know, we received a zillion opt-in messages around May 25th when the GDPR was going into force from different companies. And so different companies that were doing that were using email marketing software as a tool to help them, you know, be compliant. But the email marketing software was just a tool, and using it to ask for permission was a conscious decision by these companies so that they would be GDPR compliant. But it didn't, like, just because they bought that software didn't mean, yay, we're GDPR compliant, right?
Right.
So my, just the point of that is that you can use tools to help you become GDPR compliant, but the tools, you know, aren't going to just do it if you don't have a process that you've thought out and that you're willing to implement.
That's a really good point. Yeah. Okay. So are we ready to go on to the next topic?
I'm ready.
Okay.
Are you ready, listeners?
Yes.
If you're not ready, pause it. Come back.
If you're not already on the edge of your seat, you are really going to want to hear about how to make your, how to think about making your website and email list GDPR compliant. And again, we don't mean here are the steps that you should follow and then you'll be totally fine. We mean here are some things that jumped out at us in terms of websites and email lists. So I'm going to first talk about email lists. So here again, you're going to see a lot of conflicting advice. I certainly received, as Eve just alluded to, and I think probably a lot of you did too, these very dramatic notifications from mailing lists that I'm on saying that if I didn't renew my subscription to that list, that they were obligated under the GDPR to automatically unsubscribe me after the enforcement date, after the enforcement date had passed, which of course it now has. Mm-hmm. So this brings up the question of whether that is necessary or not. And I have actually read conflicting advice from lawyers about this, just to stress how complicated all of this is, that I've read multiple articles by lawyers that conflict about email list permission. So I think the key here is that people need to have consented in an explicit and informed way to being on your email list. So my personal take is you can keep people on your email list without asking for resubscription if a number of things are true. So number one, everyone on your list signed up through double opt-in, meaning they first filled out a sign-up form, then they clicked a link in a confirmation email saying that yes, they really, really did want to subscribe. So the GDPR doesn't mandate the kind of technology you use to do that, but it places a strong emphasis on people needing to explicitly consent to be contacted, and double opt-in is a good way to do that. So if you didn't always have double opt-in on your email list, then you might have to unsubscribe all of your EU-based people. Number two, you never automatically added people to your email list, even if they did business with you or gave you their business card or something like that. So this is a tricky one because in the US, it seems to be the norm to do this, that as soon as you do business with somebody or with a company, you are added to their email list, not only for, you know, notifications about your order or whatever, but for their newsletter or sale, you know, notifications or things like that. And under the GDPR, that may not be enough. Again, we're not experts. If this is really mission critical for you, you know, you have a mailing list with 10,000 EU residents on it. You're wondering what
more
to
power
do.
To you.
Right. Yeah. Then good for you. But also talk to an attorney.
Yeah.
If that's the case. So as an example, for years, I have been telling myself that I should add people who bought my books or took my courses or subscribed to my blog to my email list. And now I am really, really, really glad that I didn't do that, because again, that, and honestly, the reason I didn't do it was just sheer laziness. That, you know, you have to do it. It's a somewhat manual process. And I just really never got around to it. And honestly, now I'm very, very glad that I didn't, because I think under the GDPR, again, that may not qualify as explicit consent to be contacted.
And yeah, again, like
Yeah, I mean, I think this is what both of us mean about the GDPR in the end being positive, is that I feel like when I, you know, purchase something online from a business, I certainly want to be emailed about notifications related to my order, but I don't necessarily want to receive their newsletter. In many cases, I have no interest in their newsletter. And I think what the GDPR is saying is, you know, someone has to explicitly consent to the way in which you're going to contact them. So those automatic ads may, again, may be disqualified. You might have to take those people off.
What I think is really good too. Oh, I'm sorry, Corinne. I thought you were.
No, go ahead. No, I'm just going to go on with point three. So go for it.
Oh, I was just going to say that I think that, and then I lost my train of thought. So never mind. Keep going.
Okay. Just interrupt me if you remember.
Okay.
Was it related to explicit consent, not adding people just because you did business with them?
Yeah, I guess it was just the idea that we're all going to benefit from that, like you said, and just that,
yes.
You know, I think, I know what it was. It was that we're all going to benefit even, I think, from outside the EU as well, people who reside outside the EU, because I think it's going to be much too complicated for even those big companies to have two different, you know, levels or whatever. Like, it's going to be like, oh, well, they're in the US, so we treat them this way, or it's just way complicated to deal with all their data. It's just adding another layer of complication. And so I think that all of us are, I'm hoping that all of us are going to benefit from that, because they'll just have to rise to the higher standard.
Right, exactly. And I think, you know, even I have talked before about productivity tips. I think some of our listeners already know that one of my main productivity tips is mercilessly unsubscribe from email lists that you never read. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is going to solve some of that, that you think, you know, I don't really want to, you know, a place that I bought, you know, a canvas print picture for my husband for Father's Day, and I'm never going to buy anything from them again. I only did it because they were having a 90% off sale.
Right.
I don't actually want to be on their, you know, weekly newsletter about, you know, different photo storage methods. So now, instead of ruthlessly unsubscribing, hopefully I'm never going to be subscribed in the first place.
And you're right about that. Okay. When I got that inundation from different people, I thought like, no, for you, whatever, for XYZ company, I'm not going to resubscribe because you're kind of bugging me and I don't want it.
Right. Exactly. I know that you think, well, good, because I never signed up for this in the first place.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I'm thrilled to be removed.
Yeah, I'm through with you.
Yeah, so, exactly.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So point three, another factor to consider with your email list is you have to be very explicit about what people are signing up for. So for example, if your sign-up form says something like, my weekly newsletter with tips about how to become a better translator, that's what mine said. Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize at the time that that is GDPR compliant. But the point being that on my blog, it says, you know, enter your email address here to receive my weekly newsletter with tips about how to become a better translator. It does not say something like, enter your email address to stay connected with me.
Right.
So again, I think when you think about whether you have to unsubscribe all of the, or, you know, ask all of your EU resident subscribers to re-up, I think that's another question you want to ask is, were you explicit about what they were signing up for? And finally, you if I think another factor to consider is, do you have a clear and easy unsubscribe link on everything that you send out? And are people immediately unsubscribed when they click it? So one thing that I, again, another way that I think this is going to be hugely beneficial, it drives me crazy when I unsubscribe from something and it says, you know, it's going to take 2 to 3 weeks to process your unsubscribe request. That is someone who runs an email list with, you know, several thousand people on it. I think, no, it doesn't. Like when someone clicks the unsubscribe button on my newsletter, I get a notification about 30 seconds later that they have unsubscribed. And same thing, if you have something, if you have an unsubscribe feature, but the person has to remember a password in order to unsubscribe, or the person has to enter the email address from which they subscribed to your newsletter. Again, as someone who runs an email list, I can tell you those are unnecessary technological hurdles that are put there to prevent you from unsubscribing.
Well, when people do that to me, just even from the US perspective, not even GDPR, when they do that, then I actually mark them as spam for Gmail.
Yep.
You know, like I try, because I've said before that my back end is, even though it's personalized, you know, my customized email address, it's the back end is Gmail
business.
Yeah.
Right,
is that, but like you said, like I want to be kind to people too, or be nice if it's like not something spammy, but something legit, basically seems sort of legit. But if I have to do that, then I report it as spam because I don't want to see anymore. And then I, like, I've had that too. Right. You don't know your password. I don't need a password. I don't even know if that complies with US law to do that, actually.
Yeah. So I think, you know, just to review these points, because if you didn't follow those, then I think you may actually need to ask all of your EU-based subscribers to re-up their consent and unsubscribe them if they don't re-up that consent. So the ones that I identified for myself were having double opt-in in place, people not automatically added to your mailing list, being explicit about what they're signing up for, and having a clear and easy unsubscribe feature that is one click. And we should mention too, if you don't have those in place, I think especially if you don't have double opt-in, if you're adding people without explicit consent, or if you don't have an easy, a one-click unsubscribe, you should change those like today. Okay.
Yeah, thanks, Karen.
Over to you, Eve.
So just looking at a couple points about websites, I think one of the most important parts here, just from our workload standpoint, is that we don't need to reinvent the wheel. And it's perfectly legitimate to take existing privacy policies, for example, that are already GDPR compliant, and you can tweak that to your needs, because you do need to have a privacy policy, telling people how their data is going to be processed, telling them what they can do to get you to remove their data, erasure, and all that kind of thing. But on the workload part, you know, we don't have to necessarily run out right today and hire an attorney to do that, but you can certainly, and you should do that if that makes you more comfortable. But there are now a lot of GDPR compliant privacy policies out there that you can tweak it to your needs. So for example, if you use WordPress as the backend for your website, the most recent version of WordPress comes with a GDPR compliant privacy policy that you can use already, but that you actually do need to customize for your own needs. Because in fact, for the GDPR, you do need to tailor it so that it reflects your actual usage of personal data. You can't just be great boilerplate. Looks good.
Yeah. Copy and paste. Right.
Yeah. It does have to be somewhat, you know, it has to be customized, not somewhat, it has to be customized for your actual use. So then also regarding cookies, there are also many plugins for WordPress that can help you create cookies and the use of cookies that are GDPR compliant. And I actually found, a list of those. I'm sure there's other ones out there too, but I found a list of some that we can put a link to in the show notes that people can use. And did you have anything you wanted to say about cookies, Corinne?
So I guess, you know, no, not really, because at the end I'm going to talk a little bit about what I did, which includes some information about how I handled the cookie thing.
Okay, I just asked Corinne that because earlier we'd been discussing cookies. So yeah, cookies. What a fun discussion topic. Yeah. So eating them and having them on your website. So also, you need to think about forms on your website, any type of form that would collect data from people. So that could be contact forms where we say like, you know, give me your information and information about your project. Give me your email, your phone number, your name, your address, whatever. And I'll contact you with a quote. So you have to think about that too, because that means you are a data collector. You're collecting data. Then also comment forms. If people are just adding comments, then they're also giving you some of their data. They're giving you their name and different information about them. And many people are also of the opinion that you will need to install an SSL certificate so that you can allow for encrypted connections to your site while they're doing it with the forms that you have up. So you may want to check with your hosting company how to implement that, you know, or look at the technical way of how you would implement the SSL certificate in your particular case. So again, I do want to say that you don't necessarily have to do all this from the ground up. You know how like we all used to code HTML from the ground up about 20 years ago? You know, and nobody, I mean, some people do that, I guess, but you know, that you don't really need to do that anymore. So we also want to think when you're implementing these changes, you don't necessarily have to write all that from scratch. There are things out there to help you, but you don't need to reinvent the wheel. Look at what exists out there for your content manager or for your web hosting company, but you do need to customize it. And I also will put another link on the show notes as a good starting point, I think, for this kind of information is a blog post that was posted by Claire Cox on her blog, and she's a UK-based translator. And I'm sure she's getting lots of hits because it's been referenced lots of times, but she has good information on that as well. And we'll put a link to her post in the show notes.
Yeah. And I think one thing that's super helpful about posts, for example, Claire's post, or what we're trying to do today, is to just get examples of what other freelance translators have done. I know,
and
to me, that was...
And what they think is important, what they think needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm.
Is the most important. Yeah, exactly. That I think, you know, because it's such a voluminous and far-reaching law and the implementation is still hazy, that I think it's really helpful to read other people's information, exactly as you said, Eve, about here are the things that I think everybody should do right now. You know, how this shakes out in the future remains to be seen. What happens with your, you know, if you have one monster translation memory that has everything you ever translated in it, that kind of remains to be seen. But here are the things I think you should do like this week. Okay, great. So to wrap up, I thought I would talk about what I've personally done so far to attempt to get into compliance with the GDPR. So as I mentioned, I feel that for now, at least, I am pretty much okay on my email list because I've always used double opt-in. I'm clear about what people are signing up for. I never add anyone automatically, even if I've done business with them. Mm-hmm. And I have a quick and easy one-click unsubscribe link on everything I send out. I upgraded my website to the latest version of WordPress, and I tweaked the default GDPR compliant privacy policy to suit my needs. And then I added a link on that, link to that on my website. And finally, I added a pop-up cookies consent footer to my website. And in that footer, it also has a link to my privacy policy. Mm-hmm. I was already using an encrypted backup system. We didn't even touch on encryption, which is
a little bit.
Can of worms. I've been using an encrypted cloud backup system for a long time. So again, hopefully that is okay. And the last thing, the thing that is still hanging that I think I need to do is choose an amount of time for which I'm going to retain data. And then I need to go back and delete translations that have personal information that are past that retention date. Mm-hmm. And I've been freelancing for 16 years. So even if I picked 10 years, which I think is probably the longest it's reasonable to retain personal data, then I still have 6 years worth of stuff that I need to go look at.
Mm-hmm. Oh, the other thing I'm thinking of, one thing too, where I've thought like, like in some ways, I think it's good. It's helpful for us to be able to get rid of personal data as long as we, like you said, put it in our privacy policy, because then we can say, like, you know, I'll keep projects for you if you would like me to, unless you request that I do erasure, you know, for X amount of years. But then after that, we're kind of free and clear and not having to do that either.
But if the person comes back to you like 12 years later and says, you know, do you have a copy of my divorce certificate that you translated in, you know, 2006 and I paid you for, that you can say, actually, it's in my privacy policy that I delete.
Yes, exactly.
Any, you know,
So, okay, well, looking at me, I'm still assessing the impact of the GDPR as related to my business a little bit more than Corinne is. I don't have a big email list like Corinne, so that's not a big concern of mine. I am and currently working on my privacy policy that's going to be implemented on my website. And I'm like an obsessed researcher. So then I think, oh, I'm good. I can do it. And then I think, no, I got to look at this. I got to look at this. So I'm really, you know, like cut fish or what is it? I'm saying fish or cut bait. I feel like I don't feel like I'm exactly ready to do that yet. I'm still kind of researching so that I'm comfortable with the privacy policy that I come up with. And I think, as we've said, and I've read lots of different places, this is going to be an ongoing process. The process of adhering to the GDPR is an ongoing process, and it's not a one-time thing. And so I think one thing that we can comfort ourselves with is that it seems overwhelming right now, but we will all eventually integrate compliance as we become more familiar with what we need to do. And like Corinne mentioned, as we see it in action. So as actual implementation occurs throughout the world and specific court cases or specific processes, specific actions that people take are ruled upon by the different regulating authorities, then we'll learn about what implementation actually means and what the regulation means in when it's actually applied. So, and things that are coming up, you know, to me that I've been researching a lot, but I'm not ready to take a stand on just yet, are things like direct marketing to new clients that are based in Europe. I told her this, that I had this marketing campaign all planned out. I'm really excited about it. And I think it's, you know, going to be sharing information and convincing everyone to hire me. But I actually, then I freaked out because some of the people I wanted to send it to obviously were in Europe. And I felt like I had to put a hold on that because I wasn't ready. And it doesn't seem really like there's any clear direction. And like Corinne said about different aspects of the GDPR, you can read a lot of different opinions on the direct marketing, but it doesn't seem really like it's shaken out yet. And so I'm kind of still, you know, figuring out how that's going to work. And Corinne, you had a story. Can you tell that story about that company who was, you'd said who was a direct marketing company and they decided not to continue
in Europe? I mean, I think other people have probably seen this in the news, but when you think about, you know, what the impact of this could be, that I actually read, and this was related to, I think, Facebook ads, something like that, of a couple of online advertising companies that had actually decided to simply stop doing business in Europe because they could not figure out how their ad campaigns could be successful without personal targeting, and they can't figure out how to get consent for the personal targeting. So the thing is that, you know, essentially it could turn some forms of online advertising into like an ad that a company runs in the newspaper, where you're basically just hoping that someone who wants your product or service will see it. You know, you're not doing
it's not
like
specific pixel enough.
Yes, you're not using, you know, doing pixel targeting, or, you know, if any of you, I've never run Facebook ads, but just looking at them for other things, you can target those in a very, very personally identifiable way. And, you know, some companies actually saying like, we can't actually figure out how to make a business model out of this. And I think, you know, even I also have talked to a couple of Europe-based translators who said that they feel that they are being encouraged to drop some cloud-based services such as Gmail and Dropbox and things like that, because it is simply too difficult to use them in a GDPR compliant way. So I think there could be some, you know, high-level shakeups. Well, I don't think we're at that at that point yet, but I think there could be some high-level shakeups once all this, you know, comes into enforcement.
Yeah, so just thinking again, you know, I'm still kind of looking at, you know, the, I don't know, just all the things that we can, I was thinking one thing, the other thing that comes to mind is that if you are responsible for managing a Facebook group, it comes into play too. And so that kind of thing. Anyway, So I think that, as we said, the list goes on, and there's lots of things, you know, that we couldn't have covered everything in this podcast, but we hope we've given you food for thought as how to kind of start to craft your you know, approach to it. And also, I did find several resources that I thought were very helpful, and I wanted to mention those as well before we close out. The first one, which is also mentioned in the ITI's mentioned
brief,
earlier,
brief guide.
The brief 11-page guide.
It wasn't page brief guide.
They mentioned the ICO site in the UK, which is the Information Commissioner's Guide, and it has a wealth of information on the GDPR. It's specifically for UK residents, but it still has information that's helpful to us who live outside the UK or the EU as well. And then that's a good place to start. And the European Commission has a list of the other data protection authorities, is what they're called, in the various member countries. And they're like the ICO, they're independent public authorities that supervise how the GDPR is applied. And they also provide expert advice and data on data protection issues and handle complaints about the violations of the GDPR. But they're a real good source of information, that, you know, the first level and for all those other things too. So we'll also link to that. To that list of the different data protection authorities in the different member countries. And so I also highly recommend a Facebook group that's called GDPR for Translators. And the discussions they have touch on many issues. And there are also various templates provided for use and the different kinds of things that we talked about, as well as links to many other resources. And so I think that is real specific for translators and a real good place to start too. So yeah, as I mentioned, we'll list these and the other ones, the other resources mentioned previously in the show notes.
Great. So thanks everyone for listening. We hope you've enjoyed these GDPR related tips. And if you have any comments or questions, there are a few ways to reach us. So you can leave a comment on this episode on our website, speakingoftranslation.com. You can email us at speakingoftranslation@gmail.com. Or you can subscribe to us in Apple Podcasts and leave a review there. And we wanted to thank several listeners who have left us recent reviews. We really appreciate your support, and it also helps other people find the show.
Yeah, so thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you again in a future episode. And please note that this was recorded in July of 2018, for those of you who are hearing it another time, but we'll be on hiatus for the month of July, and then this is being recorded in June 2018.
There we go.
And we'll be on hiatus for the month of July, and then we'll be back in August with a new episode.
Yeah, thank you, and we'll talk to you in a future episode.